Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We are talking about Book 12, Chapter 2, What Do You Think of the Trial So Far, and General Discussion. Those were my questions. Not very inspired questions. I wasn't really sure what to ask. Uncle Jocelyn Mayer said, "Imagine the sensationalist newspaper's headlines. I am guilty, Dimitri confesses everything. In the first day of trial, Dimitri confessed he is guilty of drunkenness, but he said he is not a murderer. Rage in the courtroom, Dimitri's new scandal. He lost his temper again, more on the Karamazov case at 6. Smerdyakov's suicide. Depressed for the loss of Fyodor Karamazov, the faithful servant decided to end his days. We have the scoop." Thanks for doing that, Uncle Drossel Mayer. You can imagine. Yep. They would be saying something along those lines. Clickbait. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, in our modern times, what great clickbait titles. Yep. Clickbait has always been a thing. Somastar says, I suspect this will come to pass. Everyone perhaps felt from the first that the case was beyond dispute, that there was no doubt about it, that there could be really no discussion, and that the defence was only a matter of form, and that the prisoner was guilty, obviously, and conclusively guilty. I imagine that even the ladies, who were so impatiently longing for the acquittal of the interesting prisoner, were at the same moment, without exception, convinced of his guilt. What's more, I believe they would have been mortified if his guilt had not been so firmly established, as that would have lessened the effect of the closing scene of the criminal's acquittal. You think that's your prediction? Somastar said, that passage is what will happen. Very cool. Techrific said, trial law is a messy affair. None seem to come out looking particularly good. Fetyukovic manages to undermine the testimony of Grigory by pointing out that he's not used to drinking, and that a thimbleful is the equivalent of half a tumbler. So his eyewitness account is put in question. Rakitin is exposed for the little weasel that he is. Not that I'm biased or anything. We're starting to see a critique of the legal system being made by Dosto. We hear talk of some upcoming grand stratagem from Fetyukovic, but Dosto hints that it's not forthcoming. Fetyukovic is pointing out that the evidence is circumstantial. The spectators all know he's guilty. We know he isn't. But would we have thought any different if we were in that courtroom? As well as shining the spotlight on court proceedings, he's also making us think about the psychology of a trial. How much of it depends current societal thinking, the aptitude of lawyers involved, and underlying human tragedy that can devolve to a blood sport for bored masses? How much of it that is sheer theatre, a showdown of the involved personalities? As I said, it's messy and tragic, but it's hard to look away. What does that tell us about ourselves? Laura Weistich said, it's amazing how the critique could apply to modern trials. Doesn't seem that the system has changed much at all. I'm a Norwegian said, all the ladies were firmly convinced up to now, to the last moment, guilty. But he'll be acquitted because of the new ideas and new attitudes which are accepted now. Something that essay I summarized mentioned, along with several footnotes so far, in Dosto's dim and mistrustful view on modern scientific psychology, it's a nuance that is worth keeping in mind when people talk about Dosto's deep understanding of psychology. He certainly had that, but it was never informed by the field of psychology. I'm enjoying the trial so far. The defense seems very competent. I love the way Rakitin was deflated. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, I'm finding it impossible to read these trial chapters without comparing it to the OJ police pursuit and subsequent televised trial. June 12, 1994, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were found stabbed to death outside Nicole's condo in the Brentwood area of Los Angeles. Simpson was a person of interest in their murders. Simpson did not turn himself in, and on the 17th of June, he became the object of low-speed pursuit in a white 1993 Ford Bronco SUV owned and driven by Al Cowlings. TV stations interrupted coverage of the 1994 NBA Finals to broadcast the incident live. With an estimated audience of 95 million people, the event was described as the most famous ride on American shores since Paul Revere's. The pursuit, arrest, and trial were among the most widely publicized events in American history. The trial, often characterized as the trial of the century because of its international publicity, similar to that of Sacco and Vanzetti and the Lindbergh kidnapping, culminated after 11 months on October 3, 1995, when the jury rendered a verdict of not guilty for the two murders. An estimated 100 million people nationwide tuned in to watch or listen to the verdict announcement. Following Simpson's acquittal, no additional arrests or convictions related to the murders were made. I just made my face bleed while I was reading that. I was kind of scratching this little mole thing on my chin and I just made it bleed. So that's cool. Sorry, you probably didn't need to know that. It is a podcast, so it's not like you can see me dabbing blood off my face, but that's what I'm doing right now. You might be able to hear it if you really listen. What a pop culture extravaganza this would be, at least in America. Only in America. Thank you for those comments, everybody. That's the discussion part of the podcast done with. Skimming right on through today. Let's get ahead and read Chapter 3, The Medical Experts and a Pound of Nuts. The evidence of the medical experts, too, was of little use to the prisoner, and it appeared later that Fetyukovich had not reckoned much upon it. The medical line of defense had only been taken up through the insistence of Katerina Ivanovna, who had sent for a celebrated doctor from Moscow on purpose. The case for the defense could, of course, lose nothing by it, and might, with luck, gain something from it. There was, however, an element of comedy about it, through the difference of opinion of the doctors. The medical experts were the famous doctor from Moscow, our doctor Herzenstube, and the young doctor Varvinsky. The two later appeared also as witnesses for the prosecution. The first to be called in the capacity of expert was Dr. Herzenstube. He was a grey and bald old man of 70, of middle height and sturdy build. He was much esteemed and respected by everyone in the town. He was a conscientious doctor and an excellent and pious man. A Herngüter, or Moravian brother, I am not quite sure which. He had been living amongst us for many years and behaved with wonderful dignity. He was a kind-hearted and humane man. He treated the sick, poor, and peasants with nothing, visited them in their slums and huts. Visited them in their slums and huts, and left money for medicine. But he was as obstinate as a mule. If once he had taken an idea into his head, there was no shaking it. Almost everyone in the town was aware, by the way, that the famous doctor had, within the first 2 days or three of his presence among us, uttered some extremely offensive allusions to Dr. Herzenstube's qualifications. Though the Moscow doctor asked 25 rubles for a visit, several people in the town were glad to take advantage of his arrival and rushed to consult him regardless of expense. All these had, of course, been previously patients of Dr. Herzenstube, and the celebrated doctor had criticized his treatment with extreme harshness. Finally, he had asked the patients, as soon as he saw them, "Well, who has been cramming you with nostrums, Herzenstube?" Ha-ha. Dr. Herzenstube, of course, heard all of this, and now all the three doctors made their appearance, one after another, to be examined. Dr. Herzenstube roundly declared that the abnormality of the prisoner's mental faculties was self-evident. Then, giving his grounds for this opinion, which I omit here, he added that the abnormality was not only evident in many of the prisoner's actions in the past, but was apparent even now in this moment. When he was asked to explain how it was apparent now at this moment, the old doctor, with simple-hearted directness, pointed out that the prisoner had an extraordinary air, remarkable in the circumstances, that he had marched in like a soldier, looked straight before him, though it would have been more natural for him to look to the left where, among the public, the ladies were sitting, seeing that he was a great admirer of the fair sex, and must be thinking much of the ladies are saying of him now, much of what the ladies are saying of him now. The old man concluded in his peculiar language. I must add that he spoke Russian readily, but every phrase was formed in German style, which did not, however, trouble him, for it had always been a weakness of his to believe that he spoke Russian perfectly, but indeed the Russians better indeed than Russians. And he was very fond of using Russian proverbs, always declaring that the Russian proverbs were the best and most expressive sayings in the world. I may remark, too, that in conversation, through absent-mindedness, he often forgot the most ordinary words, which sometimes went out of his head, though he knew them perfectly. The same thing happened, though, when he spoke German, and at such times he always waved his hand before his face, as though trying to catch the last word, and no one could include him to go on speaking till he found the missing word. His remark that the prisoner ought to have looked at the ladies on entering roused a whisper of amusement in the audience. All our ladies were very fond of our old doctor. They knew, too, that having been all his life a bachelor and a religious man of exemplary conduct, he looked upon women as lofty creatures, and so his unexpected observation struck everyone as very queer. The Moscow doctor, being questioned in his turn, definitely and emphatically repeated that he considered the prisoner's mental condition abnormal in the highest degree. He talked at length and with erudition of aberration and mania, and argued that from all the facts collected, the prisoner had undoubtedly been in a condition of aberration for several days before his arrest, and if the crime had been committed by him, it must, even if he were conscious of it, have been almost involuntary, as he had not the power to control the morbid impulse that possessed him. But apart from temporary aberration, the doctor diagnosed mania, which promised, in his words, to lead to complete insanity in the future. It must be noted that I report this in my own words. The doctor made use of very learned and professional language. All his actions are in contravention of common sense and logic, he continued. Not to refer to what I have not seen, that is, the crime itself and the whole catastrophe, the day before yesterday, while he was talking to me, he had an unaccountably fixed look in his eye. He laughed unexpectedly when there was nothing to laugh at. He showed continual and inexplicable irritability, using strange words, Bernard, ethics, and others equally inappropriate. But the doctor detected mania, above all, in the fact that the prisoner could not speak of the 3,000 rubles of which he considered himself to have been cheated without extraordinary irritation, though he could speak comparatively lightly of other misfortunes and grievances. According to all accounts, he had, even in the past, whenever the subject of the 3,000 rubles was touched on, flown into a perfect frenzy, and yet he was reported to be a disinterested and not grasping man. As to the opinion of my learned colleague, the Moscow doctor added ironically, in conclusion, that the prisoner would, entering the court, have naturally looked at the ladies and not straight before him, I will only say that, apart from the playfulness of this theory, it is radically unsound. For, though I fully agree that the prisoner, on entering the court where his fate will be decided, would not naturally look straight before him in that fixed way, and that they may really be a sign of his abnormal mental condition, at the same time I maintain that he would naturally not look to the left at the ladies, but, on the contrary, to the right, to find his legal adviser, on whose help all his hopes rest and on whose defence all his future depends. The doctor expressed his opinion positively and emphatically. But the unexpected pronouncement of Dr. Varvinsky gave the last touch of comedy to the difference of opinion between the experts. In his opinion, the prisoner was now, and had been all along, in a perfectly normal condition, and although he certainly must have been in a nervous and exceedingly excited state before his arrest, this might have been due to several perfectly obvious causes, jealousy, anger, continual drunkenness, and so on. But this nervous condition would not involve the mental aberration of which mention had just been made. As to the question whether the prisoner should have looked to the left or to the right on entering the court, in his modest opinion, the prisoner would naturally look straight before him on entering the court, as he in fact had done, as that was where the judges on whom his fate depended were sitting, so that it was just by looking straight before him that he showed his perfectly normal state of mind at the present. The young doctor concluded his modest testimony with his same heat. "Bravo, doctor," cried Mitya from his seat, "just so." Mitchell, of course, was checked, but the young doctor's opinion had a decisive influence on the judges and on the public, and, as appeared afterwards, everyone agreed with him. But Dr. Herzenstube, when called as a witness, was quite unexpectedly of use to Mitchell. As an old resident in the town, he who had known the Karamazov family for years, he furnished some facts of great value for the prosecution, and suddenly, as though recalling something, he added, "But the poor young man might have had a very difficult life, for he had a good heart both in childhood and after childhood, that I know. But the Russian proverb says, if a man has one head, it's good, but if another clever man comes to visit him, it would be better still, for then there will be two heads and not only one. One head is good, but two are better, the prosecutor put in impatiently. He knew the old man's habit of talking slowly and deliberately, regardless of the impression he was making and of the delay he was causing, and highly prizing his flat, dull, and always gleefully complacent German wit. The old man was fond of making jokes. Oh, yes, that's what I say, he went on stubbornly. One head is good, but two are much better. But he did not meet another head with wits, and his wits went. Where did they go? I've forgotten the word. He went on, passing his hand before his eyes. Oh, yes, spazierian. Promenading. Wandering. Oh, yes, wandering. What's what I say? Well, his wits went wandering and fell in such a deep hole that he lost himself, and yet he was grateful and sensitive boy. I remember him very well, a little chap so high, left neglected by his father in the backyard when he ran about without boots on his feet and his little breeches hanging by one button. A note of feeling and tenderness suddenly came into the honest old man's voice. Fetyukovich positively stared as though scenting something, and caught it at it instantly. Oh, yes, I was a young man then. I was 45 then, and had only just come here. And I was so sorry for the boy then. I asked myself, why shouldn't I buy him a pound of what? I've forgotten what it's called. A pound of what children are very fond of. What is it? The doctor began waving his hands. Again, it grows on a tree and it gathers and given to everyone. Apples? No. You have a dozen of apples, not a pound. No, there are a lot of them. You put them in your mouth and crack. Quite so nuts, I say so. The doctor repeated in the calmest way, as though he had no loss for a word. And I bought him a pound of nuts, for no one had ever bought the boy a pound of nuts before, and I lifted my finger and said to him, boy, Gott der Vater, he laughed and said, Gott der Vater, Gott der Sohn, he laughed again and lisped, Gott der Sohn, Gott der Heilige Geist, then he laughed and he said as best he could, Gott der Heilige. I went away, and 2 days after I happened to be passing, and he shouted to me of himself, Uncle, Gott der Vater, Gott der Sohn, and he had only forgotten Gott der Heilige Geist. But I reminded him of it, and I felt very sorry for him again, but he was taken away, and I did not see him again. 23 years passed, I am sitting one morning in my study, white-haired old man, when there walks into the room a blooming young man, whom I should never have recognized, but he held up his finger and said, laughing, Gott der Vater, Gott der Sohn, Gott der Heilige Geist. I have just arrived and have come to thank you for that pound of nuts, for no one else ever bought me a pound of nuts. You were the only one that ever did. And then I remembered my happy youth and the poor child in the yard without boots on his feet, and my heart was touched, and I said, you are a grateful young man, for you have remembered all your life the pound of nuts I bought you in your childhood. And I embraced him and blessed him, and I shed tears. He laughed, but he shed tears too, for the Russian often laughs when he ought to be weeping, but he did weep. I saw it, and now, alas, and I am weeping now, German, I am weeping now too, you saintly man, Mitchell cried suddenly. In any case, the anecdote made a certain favourable impression on the public, but the chief sensation of Mitch's favour was created by the evidence of Katerina Ivanovna, which I will describe directly. Indeed, when the witness's aide de charge, that is called the defence, began giving evidence, fortune seemed all at once markedly more favourable to Mitchum. And what was particularly striking, this was a surprise even to the counsel for the defence. But before Katerina Ivanovna was called, Alyosha was examined, and he recalled a fact which seemed to furnish positive evidence against one important. I've got the hiccups all of a sudden. Oh, seemed to furnish positive evidence against one important point made by the prosecution. That's the end of the chapter. Probably a good thing, because I've just got the hiccups. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.